You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. New from Moultrie Mobile, the Feed Hub offers first-of-its-kind cellular connection and control for nearly any spin cast feeder on the market. When used with the Moultrie Mobile app, you can monitor feed and battery levels, run feeders on demand, receive alerts when feeders are clogged, and remotely adjust feeding times. The Feed Hub is ideal for anyone who maintains feeders. Remove the guesswork and save time by planning feeder maintenance before you drive to your hunting property. For more information, visit MoultrieMobile.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. I'm your host, Logan Medish of High Caliber History. Joining me around the table today, we have Alan from Gunbroker, Brad from Go Wild, and my brother from another hair mother, Roy Hill.
Yes, yes, we are follicularly connected forever. Follicularly connected. Follicularly familiar.
Yes, yeah, yeah, we're a follicle family.
Are you
follicle
feeling family. Weird sitting in the middle like I am now?
A little uncomfortable.
Yeah, okay, all right. Especially as a bald man.
No, so we have our good friend Roy Hill here with called a PR agency, Swanson
right,
Russell.
Right, right. I'm with Swanson Russell now. In fact, it's kind of ironic because I basically got Alan's old job. And Alan, by the way, thank you very much.
Oh, hey, they got an upgrade in my eyes.
Oh, so good.
Stepped up, yeah.
But, yeah, with Swanson Russell, we like to say we're the best agency in America for brands that work and play outside.
Ooh, I work and play outside.
Hey, there you go.
It works very well.
Yeah. But beside that, Roy is also a absolute gun nut and loves American history, and you know, there's a reason he's on with us today especially.
That's right. So today, you know, it's a beautiful spring day, and it's a perfect day to start a revolution, right? Well, start a revolution tomorrow. We're going to plan a revolution
tomorrow.
Today,
right?
And we are going to kick it off tomorrow with the shot heard round the world.
Patriots Day.
Yes, April 19th, 1775, Lexington and Concord, the shot heard round the world. And before we nerd out on that specifically, another thing that I think is interesting, you know, there were once so many British colonies in the world that the number of countries that celebrate their independence from Britain each year, it equates to there being an Independence Day every 6 days.
What was the old
course of the year?
The sun never set on the British Empire.
Which was quite literally true.
It was true, but yeah.
Is it like 64 countries or something like that?
I saw the number.
It's crazy.
It is. So there's an Independence Day literally every 6 days.
It's kind of demoralizing if you're British.
You know,
it's like every 6 days someone's celebrating not being a part of your culture.
I used to be somebody.
It's,
right?
It's like everybody's exes get together and celebrate the day they broke up.
Yeah, that's right.
Except nobody does it like the United States, because, I mean, we have a blowout party.
Oh, yeah.
And,
we do.
Know, fireworks.
You know, we celebrate it repeatedly on multiple days.
Right.
You know, that's why we're doing this episode today, because we're celebrating, you know, the shot heard around the world. And it's
with hot dogs.
With hot dogs.
Yeah, it's like core to the celebration.
Yeah.
For Independence Day, certainly. Yeah. I mean, but it's a good one for the shot. And actually, how would be the best way to celebrate this one?
I mean, hot dogs is a pretty good suggestion.
Hot dogs is never wrong. Hot dogs is never wrong.
Hot dogs is
go to the range.
Go to the range.
Yeah.
Go shoot
a flintlock. Like,
yes.
Burn some black powder.
Yes.
That is the perfect way to celebrate April 19th. Like,
cook some hot dogs over black powder.
Oh. So we are not giving cooking advice. If you get food poisoning
get
from black powder residue in your hot
burns.
Dog.
But yeah. You get that really fantastic rotten egg sulfur aroma.
Ooh, yeah.
And that essence, you know, of burned ash.
Some cultures find that a delicacy.
Yeah. I mean, ketchup, mustard, relish, gunpowder.
Gunpowder.
Ketchup on a hot dog.
Come on. I hear business opportunity. I mean, we should start a chain restaurant.
It'd be a chain of one, and you'd be in business for one day.
Cordite dogs.
Cordite. But that's too British.
Yeah.
Cordite's too British.
It's a very very unique smell, though.
Rubbing it right in the face, though.
Oh,
there you go.
Doing a victory lap.
So let's talk shot heard around the world. You know, Lexington, Concord, April 19th, 1775. You know, where what does that day and that date, what does that bring to mind to you, Roy? Like, when you think about that, what's...
And this is something that over the years I've tried to read and study about. And so one of the things I always do, and you can check my Facebook, et cetera, I always post on that day. I have a Gadsden flag, so I have a post with the Gadsden flag, and I usually have some sort of drum and fife music. So it's shot, The World Turned Upside Down. I like to have that one on there because, of course, that was the tune that Cornwallis surrendered to eventually. But the thing I always think about is for about 50 or so Americans, and nobody knows exactly how many, but that was the day they died.
Yeah.
And they died violently by being shot with muskets or bayoneted or, in some cases, even burned because the British flanking companies on the outside of the main infantry column as they retreated back from Concord Bridge. I mean, after they got shot at several thousand times, and they started just setting houses on fire.
It's a little intense.
Yeah. So I'm absolutely a proud patriot. I love the idea of the shot heard around the world, but I never want to forget just what that cost.
Because the British are a very crazy, bitter ex. You know, like, she's going to light your house on fire if you try to leave her.
And the same thing for a lot of British infantry. That was the day they died, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned we don't know exactly how many men. The other thing that we don't know, and it would be amazing if we did, as history nerds, we don't know who fired the first shot.
Right.
You know,
which is highly ironic because it's one of the most, in American history, one of the most significant single shots fired.
Absolutely.
And then there's the Ralph Waldo Emerson poem where the phrase is immortalized. But we don't know. And I've read. At the time, the British blamed those uppity peasant, damned rebel colonists, and then colonial sources says, no, it was the horrible British. They were the guys who fired the, you know, everybody wanted to blame the other person.
Sure.
But we just don't know.
We just don't know. And which is interesting. It's in stark contrast because that phrase gets borrowed again in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it gets used with World War I with the shot that Gavrilo Princip fires from an FN-1910 and assassinates the Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Right.
and so for that one, we know exactly who fired the shot, and we know the exact gun. And that gun is in a museum. And so it's interesting that phrase gets used again, you know?
And I don't mean to jump the gun, pardon the pun. Here all week. Tip your waitress. I've read your article, for example, at the Battle of Bunker Hill. We know exactly which gun.
Well, which is interesting that you bring that up because...
I love the pained historian side.
Oh, yes. I was thinking, uh-oh, what have I done?
It's the historian equivalent of actually.
Actually.
It's, you know, it, but I, unlike other historians, I will admit when wrong. You know, that video that came out was in the end of 2018, you know, so it's been a handful of years. There's been a lot of really great research on Dutch muskets that were imported and used during the 18th century and the early 19th century by a historian in the Netherlands who is a friend of mine. He's actually writing a book on it. It'll be out soon.
Oh, cool.
But unfortunately, Matthew's research has proven that that musket that is touted as the one that was firing the first shot at Bunker Hill physically could not have been here in the colonies at that time.
Okay. But I mean, that's the process of being a historian.
It is.
You go with the best evidence until more better evidence presents itself.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's because, you know, at the time we didn't know. It wasn't until Matthew is literally delving into stuff written in, you know, in his native language, handwritten in books that have been stashed away in archives for, you know, 150 years, you know, that we finally realize, you know, the truth. But that doesn't mean that the gentleman who owned that gun, you know, he was there,
right?
You know, so that was his gun at one point,
right?
but he didn't use it wasn't that,
that it
gun.
Wasn't the gun.
So it's interesting that you bring that up, you know, but that's the nature of the game with history, is that you learn more. And, you know, the guy who bought that gun and where it's on display, he is still touting it as, you know, but if I spent more than $500,000 on it, you know, yeah. But that's why, as you know, they say, buy the gun, don't buy the story, yeah. You know, and that's where we're at. So, you know, I can sell you a piece of the true cross. There's enough of those to build the ark.
Right. Right.
You know, so
I'll sell you a piece of the true ark next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So exactly.
For me, I when I'm thinking of historical events like the shot, I'm always trying to think about the mindset then and what it had to have been like to have been an average person then. Because yeah. You know, the question always comes up, how do people like the Nazi Party or the Communist Party come into play? I mean, they're obviously these evil regimes. How do the people let that happen? But you have to understand, for them, it wasn't this, you know, terrible despotic you know, leadership culture. It was just the police pulling people over. So now, you know, you're 1770s, you know, the colonies, and it's not like they're lining people up against walls and it's this obvious tyranny. So your average person, I mean, the revolution was run by a very small group of people. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was like, you know, my neighbors are just being jerks. They're, you know, rabble-rousing. They're getting the cops to come out and tear up our neighborhood. So for me, it's about the mindset of finally, this is the tipping point. You know, mm-hmm. the Tea Party's already happened. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got Sam
Boston
Adams.
Boston Massacre happened 5 years earlier. Yep.
You know, you've
the
got,
Stamp Act.
You've
Stamp
got
Act.
Sam Adams, and you've got John Payne, and everyone else just, or Thomas Paine, just going off on all the stuff. And these are, you know, conspiracy nuts and rabble rousers. But at some point, a switch is flipped, and enough of the country comes together to go, you know, we're done. Mm-hmm. You know, if you trust Ancestry.com, most of my family predates that in America. We've been mm-hmm. here a long time.
Yep.
And at some point, one of my ancestors went, you know what? I'm shooting my neighbor in the face. To hell with this. And I just try to right. picture myself today. What would it take for me to do that? And I can't imagine what it would be like.
Well, note to self: don't buy a house next to Alan.
Right. That continues to come up.
it's about to get interesting now, boys.
But the financial risk too.
Yes.
I mean, you
yeah.
know, it's not like Sam Adams was this wealthy guy. You know, right. a lot of you know, I just recently read a biography about him and was really shocked to see like how much his entire existence suffered from what he did mm-hmm. and what he went through, and really became hated by a lot of, it takes a lot of courage to do what these yeah. guys did, because to your point, you know, it's really nice. We sit here and joke about like, hey, let's have a hot dog to celebrate our
right.
independence.
Right.
But people forget how much they went through
yes.
to actually do this and how brave it was. Sam okay. Adams spent much of his life as a wanted man and, yeah. and could not mm-hmm. be out in public and couldn't be seen. And people totally don't think about what that part right. of it was actually like. You know, think of the battles, but you don't think about the years building up to this.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the British certainly, you know, to Roy's point, you know, they burned the houses kind of in retaliation of being picked off one by one. But the ones that the line troops couldn't directly engage, you know, the British government basically destroyed these people's lives, you know.
Yeah.
Seized assets, took bank accounts, yeah. ran them out of town. It was, you know, it's I mean, when you're taking on your government, it's kind of a big commitment.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we joke about, oh, they should be tarred and feathered. Like, that was still a very real punishment
that
at that
yes.
time.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, ride them out on a rail. Yeah, tar and feather them, and then ride them out on a rail. Like, right. that was, you know, and you know, we fast forward, you know, from April of 75 to July of 76, when you've got these 56 signers of the Declaration mm-hmm. of Independence. You know, had things not gone the way they did, you know,
right.
those guys were signing their own death warrant.
Right.
And
yeah.
still, even though they didn't end up signing their own death warrant, a number of those men ended up dying penniless.
Right.
You know, and,
right.
and they literally gave it all
they
up
it all.
So that these four chuckleheads could sit around a table and talk about yeah. it 2.5 centuries later.
Yeah, I mean, obviously nothing but respect for the founding fathers and the idea of democracy that they built and created. But for me, the real courageous group were just the farmers and the bankers mm-hmm. and the lawyers and
sure.
the average guys around Concord and Boston.
Right.
That decided that, you know, we're going to take the biggest gamble ever. We're going to take on, at the time, the world's greatest army.
Right.
We're nothing but some mountain guys and some farmers. And,
right.
you know, we don't know how to line up and do skirmish fire. We're going to pick them off as ungentlemanly of combat as it
total
gets.
Total chaos.
Yeah, yeah. exactly.
Yeah. Total chaos.
Right.
We don't even really have organized leadership. We don't even know where we're going to our next load of powder and shot from. But damn it, it's worth it. We're going to go for it. And the cojones it took to do that,
right.
I cannot wrap my head around the thought of it.
I also, one thing I learned about Sam Adams that I didn't know was that he was a tax collector. And I wish that today we would look at him with more reverence and say, man, he did such a great job. We should model after that, because he was apparently terrible. Like, he hated the job so much that he just, like, he's like, I'm just not going
to
do
this.
He's
the original Ron Swanson. He got into government to make government inefficient.
Right.
Dude,
right.
Oh, my God. That is such a good parallel.
Except he's got better beer than Ron.
That is true.
Yeah, that's that. The best kind of tax collector is no tax collector. That's cool. You know, we like the guy who doesn't want to show up to do his job regard. You know,
We like government inefficiency in that case.
The IRS could learn a thing or two.
There's a couple of dudes I want to talk about too, but one of my favorite regular dudes is Isaac Davis, gunsmith, just out near Concord. And Isaac knew what was up. He knew what was coming. In fact, his unit, his little group of militia, and again, the militia was just the men of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And in most places, they had to train, like today we would say once a quarter. They had to train four times a year. But Isaac Davis saw what was coming. And as a gunsmith, he made sure his dudes were fully equipped. They had proper cartridge boxes. It was like one of the few colonial militia units where everybody had their own bayonet. And I was reading an account, they were comparing his unit to another neighboring unit. They had like 40 dudes and they had one bayonet. So they all had to share, they'd take turns, right?
And who signed it out today?
Right, who signed it? John, you got the bayonet?
Most of the guys carried the pike, right? Like they carried that with them because they would
or like a sergeant or a leader would have, that's a ceremonial thing. But yeah, there were a lot of dudes with pikes too. But because he was a gunsmith, and he saw what was coming. Even as recent as November 1774, his dudes were practicing like once every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And whenever at the bridge at Concord, they put his unit number one on the bridge because they knew what the heck they were doing. They had bayonets, dude. They had bayonets. And then Isaac was unfortunately one of the first Americans killed at the bridge when the British fired on him. And then his unit fired, and that started the big retreat all the way back to Boston.
See, that foresight is what I wish we could take away from that historical moment, because, you know, okay, taxation, yeah, we're going to throw the T in there. Hey, they shoot our citizens, we're going to beat them with clubs. But when they decide they're going to go after the powder and the shot stored at Concord,
when they come confiscate the guns and the ammo,
that's when the soon-to-be country as a whole went, if they take those, we have absolutely no recourse.
There's no recourse at all.
Yep. So we can deal with taxation, we can deal with stamp acts, we can deal with everything else, but if they take our guns, we are toast, we're done. That's the point where it went, well, then we got to do this. Right. That's a lesson that I just wish we would keep in mind more often.
Well, and it's interesting, Roy, that you bring up bayonets, because when we think of, militia armament, military armament, we envision guys all training with, in air quotes, military-grade weapons.
Right.
But the average guy back then, he's bringing his own flintlock to the fight.
Yes.
And those are not in any way, shape, or form military, in air quotes, guns. The majority of the guns that these guys are using, they don't have bayonet lugs.
Right.
So they're not even capable of mounting a bayonet on that gun, unless, of course, it's a plug bayonet and you can fit it into your barrel. But so, even if things come to the point where you are in close quarters, hand-to-hand combat where a bayonet would be effective for you, they don't even have a way to mount the bayonet to the gun.
Right, New England fowling pieces, a lot of which today we would call shotguns. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so now you've just got a really big club. Thankfully, the barrels on those fowlers are really long, so you can reach out and touch someone with it. And because of the design of those guns,
you can get some Mark McGuire torque going.
And the butts on those guns are often called club butts because the design of them are just gigantic clubs. So thankfully, at least they had that going for them. Mm-hmm. These guys are not out there using military firearms. They are using the hunting piece that just a week before, maybe they were shooting squirrels or ducks or deer to feed their family, and now they're shooting lobster backs to defend their life.
Right.
Somewhere right now, our friends at Gobbler Knob Rifle, who we've had on the show before, are cringing at the thought of using their rifles.
I would never use one of Rick's guns as a club. Rick's guns are just pieces of art. And if you guys haven't seen that episode, you need to go back and watch our episode of the show with Rick Larned.
Speaking of the guns, I'm curious to hear. I've read a little bit about the range. You know, I actually started. I went down a rabbit hole. We did a long range hunting episode, and I didn't even bring up anything I learned. I just was like, "What was long range hunting back in the day?" And so I started reading about, you know, in this time area we're talking about from their hunting range,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was like 50 yards was a long shot, right? Like so, but. That aligns pretty well, and they were, like you said, they were using these guns as hunting guns. Can you talk through some of the capabilities? You mentioned bayonets, but like, what was a reasonable range for this half-trained militia?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, and a lot of that question, the answer depends on what type of gun they're using.
Right, there's a few scenarios, but I would love to hear you and Roy kind of riff on that.
Yeah, so for example, like Roy, you're talking about the fouling pieces.
Right.
You know, that's, like you said, it's akin to a shotgun, so that's a smoothbore gun. It's obviously a much larger caliber, so you can cram more stuff down that barrel, but it's not rifled, so you are going to be limited on your distance with that. So 50 yards, I mean, that's, you know, that's a reasonable distance.
Yeah. Likely a round ball.
Likely a round ball, maybe just some shot, you know, a little buck and ball, maybe if you've got it. And yeah, you know, 50 yards is probably a good poke with that.
And I've watched YouTube videos. The Cap and Ball channel, he'll do experiments with muskets. Even out to 80 yards, you can hit a man-sized target. You can't really control where on the target you hit.
Right.
But you've got a really good chance to hit it, and as you get out to 100 yards, it gets less and less likely. And there was I forget the British officer who wrote, if you opened fire on a man at 120 yards with a brown vest, you might as well fire at the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and that is why, you know, the troops line up
in
a line like that, because you may be aiming at the guy, you know, dead center, but at 95 yards you hit the dude three dudes over from the way the trajectory of that goes.
Yeah, the military of the year of that era, the doctrine was not like we see now. You're on the range, target practicing, working on accuracy. Then it was the training was really about the loading.
Right.
Keeping the guns going, and then you made a human shotgun out of the skirmish line.
Right.
Well, human shotgun.
When they ran into the American Revolutionary Militia, these were guys who had basically their sustenance depended on them hitting a game animal.
Yep.
So it was aimed fire. You know, they were doing turkey shoots and little competitions around the home. So accuracy was in their world, so they could take single shots and pick people off, where the British troops at first just didn't even have that training or capability.
Right, and the muskie usually has only a front sight, a sight at all, and a rear sight. Now, Logan, did you ever do any battle reenactment in the past?
It's funny you bring that
up. Be prepared for the photos, my friend.
Yeah, I spent a number of years doing reenactment.
I thought you probably did.
Have you seen his IMDb credits?
Oh, I've got to look this up. I'm not surprised one bit.
I
was never that hardcore because I always had an interest in history. I did participate in about three different Civil War battle reenactments. And the other thing to remember is there's no radio communication back then.
Yep.
The troops have to get in those tight formations because the only way you can get a cohesive group of soldiers to do something is they've got to be all close enough together to hear shouted commands over musket fire.
Or the drums
or a bugle call, but they don't have radio communications. They don't have any amplification system. And then, I'll never forget the lesson I learned. I was in a two rank. We were about 50 dudes in two ranks, and the group that we were supposed to pretend to fight in the battle reenactment, there was just this open field with rolling hills, no trees, grass was maybe that tall, and we freaking lost the enemy unit in an open field because because we crested one hill and okay, there they are like a couple hundred yards away, and then we go back and we march and we come up the next set of hills, and all of a sudden they appeared out of nowhere on our right flank, like 50 yards away. They came up over the hill and we go, yeah, right. Because, you know, of course it was just for show and reenactment, but we would have all just been dead.
Well, and the other thing that people don't take into consideration is all of the smoke from the black powder.
Yeah.
Now, if you're lucky and it's you've got a little bit of a breeze going, you know, it's going to blow that smoke out of the way. But there have been a number of times where I've been at events doing things and you got both sides and you've got all the guns going off at once and it's a still day. And it's like, I mean, you're literally walking into a cloud
you can't
see them. You could be 30 yards away from those guys and You can hear them.
Yeah. But and you see them. Muzzle flash through the smoke.
Right, but you don't know where they're at.
You don't know where they're at. Yeah.
The fog of war used to be a very literal thing.
Very literal thing. Yeah. Yes, very literal. But, you know, but so, Brad, we talked about, you know, the fouling pieces, the, you know, the smoothbore guns, but there were also some guys shooting actual rifled guns.
Completely different animal.
Completely different animal.
But that ended up being a big advantage over the British, right? Because it added, like, I think I was reading like 20 or 30 yards even.
At least.
At a time. These are being evolved. And, you know, to your quote, the quote of the British guys, like, you might as well shoot at the moon.
Yeah.
Like, they had nothing that could compete. So when you're talking about shooting from the woods, which I believe they learned from, you know, fighting with Native Americans.
Absolutely.
Really, you know, it was a pretty big game changer.
Yeah. Right?
And we almost gave that advantage up, though. Because once we got the militia starting to form up under, you know, the proper generals, mm-hmm. we then tried to emulate the British in skirmish lines,
right.
Which we kind of got our butts handed to us.
Yeah.
Right. But eventually they had to learn how to fight. Is it Baron von Steuben? Is that the German officer mm-hmm. that recommended by Benjamin Franklin, who finally helps whip the colonial army into shape
at
where
Valley
they can
Forge.
They can actually mm-hmm. face the British. But it yep. takes a while.
It does. It takes a while.
And the Americans lose just about all the battle.
Yeah. Right. And you know, and so we obviously you're gaining range with the rifle.
Right.
But they are not nearly as prevalent
no.
in terms of ownership as a smoothbore gun.
Yeah.
Especially not in New England. And that's
right.
because, you know, with a fouling piece, you can kill any animal
yeah.
that you're looking at,
right.
but like you're not shooting a 36 caliber rifle at a duck.
Right.
Up in the, you know,
right.
just like right. you don't take a Winchester Model 70 duck hunting today. You know, you didn't take a rifled piece to duck hunt in 1775
right.
yeah. either.
And let's not overlook the manual arms. Loading a rifle in that period was not a fast event.
Much right. slower than loading a musket.
Yes, you can right. load a musket and fire it like three times in the time it takes to load one rifle.
Yes, because yep. you're just literally down that smooth barrel, whereas with the rifled guns, you know, you are fighting
patched
the rifling
yep.
all the way down. So
yep.
it's a big difference.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I was I read apparently John Adams, when he went to the First Continental Congress, he wrote a letter home to his wife, and he wrote of the strange peculiar musket he encountered there called a rifle that was carried by the backwoodsmen of Virginia and Pennsylvania and Maryland. So yeah, much more of a frontier thing, much more of a weapon suited for use in the woods, hunting deer, etc. But I mean, with the rifleman, what's his name? Timothy Murphy took down the British general at the Battle of Saratoga a few years later. It was like 250, 300 yards.
Was that the famous they couldn't hit an elephant at this?
Oh, that's
Civil War.
Okay. That's General John Sedgwick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They couldn't hit an elephant. And that was probably a Whitworth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Down you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've shot, this is off on a tangent, but I've shot a Whitworth rifle, which is a hexagonal
yes.
bore Civil War air gun. But I've reached out and touched stuff at 600 yards
oh, yeah.
with one
yeah.
of those
yeah.
guns.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
but.
Going back to the Revolutionary War, the rifle obviously made most you know famous now by the Green Mountain Boys, which were, I mean, the Appalachian backwoods hunters that
right.
they didn't hit target, they didn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
So they were
right.
exceptional
right.
marksmen, used to shooting from positions
right.
of cover and concealment,
right.
and taking them one at a time.
Right.
Very, very ungentlemanly in
right.
the British
very,
eyes.
Yes, and that was a common theme because, of course, the social stratification of Britain and the idea that the proper gentleman
yes.
needed to be in control of the rabble, the common rabble of the infantry, and it was not kosher to whack officers. And
this day and age, we would yeah. call them guerrillas, insurgents, and terrorists.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes,
exactly.
absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Well, we've reached a point now where I think we've planned our strategy quite well, but the day is getting long, and I hear that there may be some trouble brewing tomorrow morning. And
right.
so I think it's best we all retire to our homes, square things away at the household. And
want to meet at the bridge in the morning?
Right.
Yeah, make sure you got fresh flints in your guns,
Ton
boys.
Tavern, yeah. I'll see you at Ton Tavern about 4 o'clock in the morning.
And we've got some things fixing to kick off, and I'm looking forward to seeing you guys tomorrow morning. So best of luck to you all.
Good luck to you. I don't have a bayonet. Can I borrow yours?
I don't have one either.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, that's it for another episode of the No Low Ballers podcast. Appreciate each and every one of you who has tuned in either on the audio version or the video version. Make sure you're subscribed on your favorite platform. Leave us some likes and comments and reviews. We do read and respond to it all. We appreciate each and every one of you being here and consuming this show, because hopefully you're having as much fun watching it as we have making it, because without you, there is no us, and we love being us. We have a great time on this show. So we will see you right here on the next episode of the No Low Ballers podcast.